I'd like to read you one more passage of Scripture. And this comes from the book of Deuteronomy, the 15th chapter, the 11th verse. And before I read, I need to tell you, this is the verse where Jesus shared the first part of this verse in during the Last Supper. And a lot of times we use this that first part of the verse and forget the second part. In the way that we hear it in the New Testament, it says, "The poor will be with you always." But there's more to that verse. So let me read it to you in the way that the whole verse is supposed to go. "Since there will never cease to be some in need on the earth," or "since the poor will be with you always, I therefore command you," I being God, "open your hand to the poor and needy in your land. Since there will never cease to be some in need on the earth, I therefore command you, open your hand to the poor and needy in your land." As you heard me tell the children a few moments ago, today is Children's Sabbath, a time to remember the needs of all God's children. While those needs are numerous, the root cause of so many of those needs seems to be poverty. Now, we have all seen those pictures of poverty-stricken children in Haiti, in Darfur, in Indonesia, and many other places around the world. According to the Children's Defense Fund, however, it's not just the third world where children are encountering poverty. Children in the United States face the hardships of poverty as well. Perhaps the following statistics might interest you. In 2008, just before the recession was beginning, 14.1 million children in America were poor, an increase of 2.5 million since 2000. More than 5.6 million children were in families living at half the poverty level or less. For a family of four, that means $919 a month, $212 a week, or $30 a day. Children in extreme poverty increased by 1.6 million between 2000 and 2008. There were more poor Hispanic children than Black, American Indian, Alaska Native, or Asian Pacific Islander. Black and Hispanic children were more than twice as likely to be poor as white non-Hispanic children. Children in female-headed families were the most likely to be poor, four times as likely as children in married-coupled families. Nearly 70% of poor children lived in families where at least one family member had a job. More than half of all poor children lived in eight states. And I thought these states were interesting. Listen, California, Texas, New York, Florida, Illinois, Georgia, Ohio, and Michigan. And more than half of all children in extreme poverty lived in those states, plus Pennsylvania. Not the states you would normally expect, were they? Child poverty rates ranged from 30.4% in my adopted state of Mississippi to 9% in New Hampshire. The child poverty rate in Nebraska stood at 15%. And finally, there were almost as many poor children living in the suburbs as there were in the urban areas. Now, if all of those statistics don't impress you, and I know that statistics don't impress a whole lot of people, then perhaps this picture up here will. I would like to introduce you to a family that I met several years ago. They live on the side of a mountain somewhere near the border of West Virginia and Kentucky. I met them when I took a youth group from one of my churches in Mississippi to participate in the Appalachia Service Project, a ministry of the United Methodist Church that does home repair in one of the poorest regions in all of our country. Mama Jeannie, that's Mama Jeannie sitting on the chair up there, was the main caregiver to her two grandchildren, Julie and Jack. They lived in the house that you see on the screen, one of the worst homes that I have ever seen. The floor had caved in, all of the windows were broken, and the roof leaked. My youth and I were assigned to fix the roof, but the house had electrical problems. And any time we walked over to the spot that we were supposed to repair, our feet started to tingle, which was not a good sign. So we ended up only replacing the glass in the windows. Now the reason that Mama Jeannie and her two grandkids lived in that particular situation are just too numerous to count. Those two children were innocent victims of so many things that had gone wrong everywhere. But what my youth group and I quickly realized was unless those things were fixed, unless the cycle of poverty was somehow broken, little Jack and Julie would grow up to be just like Grandma. The grips of poverty in which they found themselves would not be broken. Now it's clear that poverty is devastating many of the world's children, including many right here in the United States. Hundreds of thousands of our nation's children just like Julie and Jack, go to bed hungry every night. Hundreds of thousands of children are left unattended as their parents try to eke out a living. Hundreds of thousands of children live in homes that do not meet even the most minimum of standards. In a country like ours, that is simply unacceptable. Unacceptable that our children must suffer like that. Only the most callous of Americans would disagree with that assessment. So how do we fix it? How do we solve the problems that poverty creates? Most of us are smart enough to know that's where the problem begins. Unfortunately, poverty has become one of those hot-button political issues. Those on one side of the issue will tell you that the hold that poverty has on the lives of children will not be broken until certain personal issues are addressed. Those on this side of the debate see poverty directly related to the problem of broken families. Until fathers and mothers take more responsibility for their children, this side says, nothing will change. Those on the other side of the issue, however, tend to see things a little bit differently. They say that the hold that poverty has on children's lives will not be broken until certain social issues are addressed. Having good family values doesn't assure anyone of having a job that pays a living wage. Until businesses and governments take more action to protect children, this side says, nothing will change. Now, both sides have very valid points. Both sides have important contributions that they could make to the discussion. Yet, as you probably know, neither side wants to listen to the other. Neither side wants to concede that the other might have their finger on an important part of the problem. So they don't listen to each other. Because they don't listen, nothing ever gets done. And poverty persists. Children, those who are the most vulnerable of all, continue to suffer. It's frustrating. It doesn't seem right. The children of our great country, not to mention the world, simply do not deserve so much inaction. So, what can we do? Well, if this past week's rescue of the miners in Chile teach us anything, is that there are solutions to seemingly impossible situations. People can come together to work out a plan. But how can this happen when people are so divided? Well, perhaps we could take a cue from today's parable. Let's take a closer look at what Jesus said. Before we do, we got to go back just a little. You see, while on his final journey to Jerusalem, he shared some of his most important words with his disciples. In the verses immediately preceding today's parable, Jesus talked to them about the coming of the kingdom. Just like now, his followers were full of questions like, when will it happen? And how long will we have to wait? Rather than giving them the answers they wanted, Jesus simply told them to be faithfully persistent, to keep on keeping on until the kingdom did come. And to illustrate the type of persistence that he expected, he told them a parable that Luke introduced by saying, then Jesus told them a parable about the need to pray and never lose heart. Jesus told them a parable about the need to pray and to never lose heart. Now, the literal translation of that verse is to pray and not to faint, rather than to lose heart. To pray and not to faint. Words that are reminiscent of the promise that we find in Isaiah that says, those who wait upon the Lord shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. In other words, Jesus called his disciples to never, ever give up. With this, we should know right away what the point of this story is going to be. But let me give you a little more background before we get to that point. This particular parable, as you know, has just two characters. The first was a judge. Rather than naming Jerusalem or Nazareth, Jesus said that this judge lived in a certain city, allowing this parable to be universal in nature. That is also the reason that this powerful man remained nameless. Now, just like today, judges in biblical times were people who had the responsibility to fairly settle disputes, to impartially make decisions, and to restore justice in situations that demanded it. That was his job. For whatever reason, however, this particular judge was unable to make those kinds of judgments. That is because Jesus told us that he was not fair, he was not impartial, and he was not just. He was not the even-handed kind of person that his office or the people needed him to be. How bad was he? The Greek verb that our translations have as had no respect can also mean he had no sense of shame. He had no sense of shame. He was the kind of jurist, talking about terrible Texas people like we were earlier today. He was the type of person that would have made Judge Roy Bean very, very proud. Now the second person in this parable was a widow. In biblical times, widows were virtually powerless. A widow had limited rights, could not inherit her husband's property, and her daily survival depended upon the generosity of her closest male relative, if she was so fortunate as to have one. There was no organized social welfare system on which a widow could depend. As a result, many widows found themselves completely alone and therefore had to rely upon judges for fairness and protection. You may remember that the Hebrew scriptures are filled with passages telling how God was concerned about injustices against those who had little or no power. Prophets like Isaiah and Amos tell us that Israel would be judged on how it treated its widows and its orphans. Jesus gained his concern about the least of these from these centuries-old teachings of the prophets. Both the Old and New Testament says that widows and orphans are of special concern to God, and people were expected to deal with them fairly. But as we already know, this particular judge felt no need to act in that way. And with that knowledge, we can finally take a look at the parable. Needing justice for some unnamed situation, that widow appeared before the judge, who quickly dismissed her out of hand. Jesus told us that his reason for doing so was that he neither feared God, he had no respect for what the prophets had taught all of those years before, and he didn't care a lick about people. In other words, he simply didn't care. But not willing to take no for an answer, the woman went to plead her case once again. And once again, she was quickly dismissed. The judge still refused to grant the justice that that woman so desperately needed. But this widow, as we know, was very, very persistent. Still unwilling to take no for an answer. And after appearing in that court several more times and pleading her case, the judge finally gave in and granted her what she wished. According to Jesus, he did so because he feared that she will wear me out by continually coming. She will wear me out by continually coming. The literal translation of that verse is much more telling and a whole lot more fun. The judge says that he feared that she will give me a black eye. She will give me a black eye. Now there's no need to dwell on the question of whether that black eye was of the literal or the figurative variety. What is important for us to remember is that this parable was part of Jesus' answer regarding what to do until the kingdom came. And part of that answer is to persist faithfully, to keep on keeping on until that time. The parable merely illustrates that point. And if a poor, and here's if you're not paying attention, this is a good time to tune in, because here's the big point. If a poor, vulnerable widow could be so persistent as to get a big, bad judge to do the right thing, even if he did so for the wrong reasons, then just think what you and I can do with the help of God. Just think what you and I can do with the help of a God who loves us and who is not at all like that unjust judge. When we look at the needs of children in poverty and the inability of today's leaders to do much of anything about it, perhaps we need to take a lesson from the widow in Jesus' parable. There may be times, that there may be those opportunities when we will be able to appeal to the best intentions of our elected leaders and watch them do the right thing for the children of our nation in our world. They will see the need and spring into action for all of the right reasons. There may be other times, however, when those pleas will go unheard. And we will need to constantly exert all the pressure we can so that those elected leaders will eventually do the right thing, even though it may be for the wrong reason. Despite the obvious, they will not be able to see the need and will have to be embarrassed into taking action. And based upon the way that most issues tend to get bogged down in partisan politics, whether those politics take place in Lincoln or in Washington, probably I would imagine that 9 times out of 10, we're going to have to be ready to give a few black eyes. Like the widow in the parable, we may need to be so persistent that they'll simply have to do the right thing to save face. And perhaps we need to start by telling our leaders over and over again, enough already of offering those false choices. Earlier, I told you how one side tends to see the solution to the problem of poverty in the context of personal responsibility, while the other side seems to see the solution to the same in the context of social responsibility. Both sides are able to see part of the problem. Each side is able to offer half of the solution. But it's patently dishonest for both sides to offer the false choice of either a family or a community when it comes to lifting a child out of poverty. The needs of impoverished children cannot be reduced to the agenda of the political right or left. Children need both a loving family and a supportive community if they are ever going to be everything that God created them to be. The false choices offered by both sides do nothing but continually hurt the children of our land. Take another look at Mama Jeannie and her two grandchildren. Look at the house in which they live. Look at the way those two children are dressed. And by the way, Jack wore the same diaper all week. They just emptied it out when they needed to. Think about that for a minute. And as you think about that, and thank God that you're not living in a situation like that, begin to realize that poverty is something that simply cannot be wished away. It takes work. It takes pressure. We need to encourage our leaders not only to find ways to overcome the prevalence of single-parent families, but also find ways to bring employment to certain areas that those parents live, so that like the parents of Jack and Julie will not have to leave their children with caregivers in order that they can find work. We need to encourage our leaders not only to find ways to strengthen marriage, but also find ways to establish affordable housing so that those marriages can flourish. We need to encourage our leaders not only to find ways to reduce the rate of premarital sex, but also find ways to reduce the way our society uses sex to sell absolutely everything. In other words, we need to encourage our leaders to understand that the solution to the problem of children and poverty is not just a matter of personal or social responsibility, but both. And if our leaders don't listen the first time, then we need to take a page from the Persistent Widow's Playbook and go back again and again and again until those leaders do what they need to do. For our children deserve nothing less. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the pastor and thorn in the side of Nazi Germany, once wrote, "The test of morality of a society, the test of the morality of a society is what it does for its children." Mahatma Gandhi, the father of modern India, often said, "You can judge a society by how it treats its weakest members." And Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, which, by the way, is not a law firm, tells us to teach your children well. And once we do, then we must go on and teach our youth and our adults and our leaders and our politicians just the same. We must remind them that for the sake of God and country, we cannot ignore the needs of our children. We must remind them that, as the old song goes, red and yellow, black and white, they're all precious in His sight. And we must do it over and over and over again until they finally get it. Now, I once had a pastor who used to say at the end of every sermon, "Think on these things."